I actually turn those on.
That'd be good. There you go, Mira. Turn it on.
Is this staying up?
Yeah.
All right, will you talk?
You can hardly stop me.
Good. Okay. Will you talk too?
Yes, actually, I believe that I can.
Now you talk.
Yes, I believe that I can. Okay. The microphone, even though the microphone is off.
Well, I'm checking how loud this one is because it's picking up quite a bit. Like, I can hear.
Me breathing? Oh, yeah.
Well, I can hear myself standing over here. So I'm just going to turn that one down a little bit. So
okay.
We can hear you.
Okay.
Not necessarily us on the other side of the table. Okay, we can turn that one back on. All right, will you talk into that one?
Yes. Good morning, Beth and Emily. How are you?
We're just tip top, Mir.
Perfect. Okay. Okay, so this is a test oral history interview for the Dominican Oral History Archive Project taking place on May 7th, 2021 at the McGreal Center offices in River Forest, Illinois. So we're going to start here with some biographical questions. And before we start, will you state your full name for the microphone so we know who we're interviewing here?
My name is Sister Elizabeth Megan.
Okay. And Mary?
My name is Sister Mary Kramer.
Okay. So let's start, and we're going to have both answer these biographical questions. So Beth, why don't we start with you? When and where were you born?
I was born in Evergreen Park at Little Company of Mary Hospital in October 17, 1941, but I lived in Chicago.
Okay, and Mary?
I was born in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, April 21st, 1940.
Let's do a little brief description of your family and childhood.
I was born into my parents, Frank and Mary Megan, and my sister, Loretta, who was 13 and a half when I was born. And there were just the two of us.
And Mary?
I was born into a family of, eventually we numbered six, a mom and a dad and four kids. And I was the first in the family. They called me Mary Elizabeth. And we grew up in a small town in Wisconsin, Fond du Lac. It was very, very Catholic town. I went to Catholic school for grade school, for high school, and then I came to Rosary College in September of 1958. I enjoyed my childhood. I enjoyed friends. I enjoyed the small town. I felt very good about myself during those years, probably because of the nurturing my parents had provided for me and my siblings.
That's a good transition to our next question of what is your family's religious background?
My parents were both Catholic and for generations, and my sister as well.
And my parents were both Catholic. They grew up in very different Catholic communities. My father grew up in a house that was across the street from the mother house of the Sisters of St. Agnes. And I think, as I remember his storytelling, there were many times in which priests came to the house or were entertained there. My mother grew up in a lumber camp, Leona, Wisconsin, in northern Wisconsin, and they had the services of a traveling priest. So the difference between the two is that my mother said, I'll do the housework, Dad'll do the praying. And that's kind of how it ended up. Dad was philosophical, knew a lot of theology, liked theology. Every day of his life that he was able, he went to Mass. And Mom was a practical housekeeper, but Catholic as well.
So now we're going to switch off questions here between Sister Mary and Sister Beth. So starting with Sister Beth, as an adolescent, how did you think about vocation?
It's so long ago that I not sure that my memory serves me right, but I believe that that God had a plan for everyone, and that he called some people to religious life, he called some people to the single life, and he called some people to marriage. So the trick, of course, of childhood was to figure out where you were being called.
And did you feel that early on?
No. I didn't. Early on, where was this that I answered this question for someone just recently? Maybe it was here. When I was about 7 or 8, I wanted to be a yo-yo instructor. And then I had a family friend who was a captain. She was a captain in the Chicago Police Force, and she had just great stories capturing crooks on the subway. And so I thought that might be nice, too. And so, but the first thing that I probably realized is that I wanted to teach. I thought it was the most important thing a person could do with their life. And actually, I still do. But so that part was easy. And I thought I would like to have children, of course, and be married, okay, and so forth. I remember my sophomore homeroom teacher sitting down next to me. Everybody else was doing something else evidently. And she said, "Beth, have you ever thought about being a sister?" And I remembered, without missing a beat, I said, "No, sister, I want to get married and have children." "Okay," she said. "Okay." You see, that was my sophomore year. At the end of my junior year, my aunt, who was a sister, took me to the mother house, to the mound, supposedly to be her companion, because she had to go to the mound. God knows why she had to go to the mound. It wasn't for correction. She was a very holy type. Anyway, I liked it. And the two novices that they had show me around had been seniors at Longwood when I was a freshman. And one, Mary Lou Beck, who eventually left, was the president of the athletic association. So she was a big deal at our school. So anyway, so I thought, oh, and it was so beautiful. It was a summer day, you know, sunshine on the mound. Anyway, I thought, well, if I ever was going to be a nun, you know, I'd want to be that kind. But I also read books about different orders and so on and so forth. Anyway, by the time I was a senior, I had decided that, yeah, that would be a good idea. Well, my parents weren't too excited about this, despite their Catholicity and the fact that we already had a nun in the family. And that was because I was only 16 when I graduated from high school. Thus, they had me stay on for another year. I went to St. Xavier's for a year from college, and then I entered.
That's, I think you kind of went over your early experiences with sisters during child and adolescence, but is there anything else you want to add as far as those experiences?
No, I thought that the nuns were great, even the ones that weren't great. You know, in the sense that as a totality, they made a big difference in my life. Outside of my parents, the sisters were certainly the greatest influence on my childhood. Oh, I should better throw Loretta in. Loretta, of course, was too, my sister.
Okay, so Mary, what led you to choose Dominican religious life?
Oh, well, I came to Rosary College in September of 1958 as a freshman, and I was here a year. And the thing that attracted me to the Dominican sisters was their joy. I remember sitting in the library evening after evening, supposedly doing my homework, and watching these sisters come through the library laughing and joking and talking to people through this big, long library. And I thought, oh, well, that looks, I think I could do that. So that was it. Didn't take much.
And was that your first experience of Dominican sisters?
Yes, yes. Before that, I had sisters in elementary school and high school who were basically German, like I am in foundation. And I think that the severity of the life they lived was not attractive to me.
So specifically the Dominican order and what you saw there?
Was joy, was an expression of joy, yes.
So what led you to choose the Dominican congregation of which you are now a member?
Well, it was the only group I knew. And And so when I was a freshman in college, I was going with a boy who was a year older than I, and he was going to school in the East, and he said, he wrote after Christmas, he said, if you don't come out here to go to school next year, I don't know what I'm going to do. Well, all I could think of was him doing all kinds of things with other women. And I thought to myself, no, you know what? I'm not ready to make a commitment to this guy. Besides, I think I'll look at the Dominicans. So that's what happened. They were the first group that I saw.
So how do you remember your earliest formation in religious life?
Well, being German, I did everything I was asked to do. I remember, and I was asked to do big things. You know, not only leave home, not only wear this black outfit, not only wear these, what I called grandmother shoes, but we were taught to bow. When you walked down the hallway and you there was a statue on the side, you were to bow to that statue. And I did all that stuff. And I did it because I thought it was God's vocation. It wasn't really mine. And so I was expected to do that. But that was also in the days, I think, when the current theology at that time was to give up your own will, not to make choices for yourself about anything, but to do what someone else asks you to do. That was holy. And so, of course, I wanted to be holy, and I wanted to be successful in whatever I was supposed to, whatever I was being asked to do. So I pretty much toed the mark. It wasn't until Vatican II came along that I began to think otherwise.
Did you expect those restrictions when you joined the congregation?
I had no idea. None. And to tell you the truth, to think that I wanted to go to the Dominican Mother House to learn how to be a sister when I knew nothing about their life baffles me. I shouldn't say that. I should say, in the summer of my senior year, the Sisters of St. Agnes were celebrating some big event. And one of my high school teachers asked me to be in this movie. So I was in a movie with the Sisters of St. Agnes my senior year of high school. And I had to get dressed up like a Sister of St. Agnes and do some of the things that they did. But I mean, I didn't sit at table with them, but I went to their sewing classes and I played outside with them. But I didn't see that as like what sisters really do. So again, I say didn't know anything about it.
So what experiences in your Dominican religious life have been most life-giving?
Well, I've had so many, and I'm telling you in the order in which they come to my mind. The first one is meeting a sister who then became a lifelong friend, Sister Marcella Conley. I met her in Bolivia, and I met her over a fight about Jesus. I had been a high school religion teacher in this country, and she was being a missionary, and we would sit at the table, and she would ask me what I knew about Jesus. And I said, well, yeah, that's a book I have on my shelf, but I don't read it. Well, then we formed this great friendship, and she became just a wonderful, 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 intimate, loving friend whose example has taught me a lot. Then I think the other big thing was Vatican II. And that changed, that opened up the convent doors. I'm not going to go into every detail, but it allowed us to embrace people up close and personal, mm-hmm. and also gave us a new way of being sisters. And it also changed our lifestyle, like, you know, the clothes that I'm wearing today no longer are part of a sister's habit. So those two things were big. Then I think another thing that I learned from my grandmother, and my very... After I'd been at the Mother House to learn how to be a sister for 6 weeks, my family came to visit on a Sunday afternoon. And my grandmother, who spent the fall hunting season with my parents in Fond du Lac, hunting and sewing, came with them. And the only thing I remember out of that whole visit is my grandmother said, Mary, when you grow old, and she was old at that time, when you grow old, you'll have someone to care for you. I said, oh, Grandma, thank you. I had no idea what she was saying. I had no idea what I was saying. but now I realize that the third most important thing is belonging to a community of women from whom I have learned how to think differently and live differently in a lifestyle that I truly cherish today. So those are three. There probably are more, but we're not going to keep talking.
Whoa. You said you went to Bolivia. Did joining the order give you chances to travel or see things that you might not have done otherwise?
Well, yes, interestingly enough, this boy that I told you about earlier that I said no to, he was at the Naval Academy. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself when I said no, I don't want to come out and go to school in the East. I don't want to spend the rest of my life traveling around the world, living 2 years here, 4 years here, 4 years here. Well, that's exactly what happened when I became a Dominican sister. We went from place to place to place. But by then, moving around didn't make any difference because God's people are everywhere. So irony came back to bite me.
Did you enjoy any particular place more than others?
No, I can't say that. Some places, I just mark them off on my calendar. They weren't, and that was before Vatican II. So Vatican II changed everything for me. But before Vatican II, these were places where I spent all my time being a school teacher. You know, getting up in the morning, praying with the sisters, going over to school, coming home from school, studying, spending the weekend writing letters or cleaning or something like that. But then when things began to open up, that's when I really began to enjoy life. And when at some point in time, and it came on little by little, not an overnight flash, when I realized that I now had permission to do my own theologizing. I didn't have to listen to what other people were saying about who God is. I could decide that for myself. And so it gave me permission to think independently, not only doing my own theologizing, but also thinking about other issues in life.
So what have been some of the biggest challenges as a Dominican sister, or more broadly as a Catholic sister?
Well, again, my focus is on Vatican II. So I suppose the biggest challenge is the resistance that came about from Pope John Paul II, Benedict XVI, and whoever else came after him, not seeing the church in the same way that I see the church. Challenges. Well, that's it. I can't think of any more. Because I realize, if probably in retrospect, that everything that might have been a challenge at first really came into my life as a blessing. Mm.
Can you give an example?
Well, yes, I'm thinking about going to Bolivia. I was teaching at Cathedral High School in Omaha, Nebraska in 1969, and a letter came out from the mother house. It was posted on the bulletin board. I said, sisters in Pochabamba, Bolivia are looking for two sisters to join them. And I looked at that letter and I thought, well, who's this for? Well, it must be for me. So I thought, oh, I know. I know somebody who will go to Bolivia with me, Sandy Goman. So I called her up on the telephone. I said, Sandy, did you get this letter from Sister Maria Amanda? She said, yes. I said, well, what do you think? You want to go to Bolivia? She said, well, isn't that interesting? Sister Melissa talked about that with me at Edgewood College this summer. I said, well, should we try it? And she said, yes. So I went to our superior, Sister Mary William, and I said, Sister Mary William, I want to respond to that letter out there on the bulletin board. And she said, oh, well, she said, that's nice. She said, the first thing you do is call Sister Raymonda. This is the funny part. And so I called Sister Raymonda, and I said, Sister Raymonda, we got this letter from you asking for two people to go to Cochabamba, Bolivia, and I want to go, and Sandy Goman wants to go. Oh, she said, that's very nice. That's good of you. I said, but first I have to go home and ask my parents. Long pause. She said, Mary, she said, you have a religious vow. She said, you can go home and tell your parents, but you don't ask your parents. when I told my parents, and then I started to study Spanish at home at night at like 11 o'clock at night in my bedroom. And 3 months later, Sandy Goldman and I went to Bolivia. So it was a challenge to respond to that letter, but it turned out to be just a wonder. It gave me a whole new insight on life. So that was it. That I had many turning points in my life, but that was one of them.
Did you find any challenges in living in community?
Well, yes, I did. But I took the easy way out. I just kind of bypassed those people I didn't like. Mm-hmm. I didn't spend any time with them. I didn't choose to be with them. And I just navigated around the boat. And then I learned, oh, this was in Bolivia too. We had a sister, Guadalupe Soria. And I said, I'm not getting along with so-and-so. She said, Mary, pray for her. I thought, oh, really? She said, yes. She said, it'll change your heart. And so I did. And it worked. It was like medicine. It worked. So that was helpful. I haven't had any real knockdown dragouts with anybody.
In your experience, is that pretty normal for people living in community? You know, just avoiding where there might be conflict and praying through that?
I don't know. I've never talked to anybody else about it. Mm-hmm.
So moving on to the Dominican Mission. Beth, how would you define the Dominican Mission?
Well, if my memory were better, I could read you our mission statement. But basically, our mission is to help to bring about the reign of God through preaching and teaching and working for a holy and just church and society. And we do that in so many different ways today. You know, when we entered, everyone was basically a teacher in some way or shape or form, or administrator, whatever. But it's a broad mission, and yet it has enough focus that makes Dominicans distinctive.
How have you lived out that mission?
I have lived out that mission for the most part in education, in some form of education. Elementary school teaching when I was very young, college teaching briefly in a few different places, and as a principal 3 times, as a superintendent of schools 3 times. So it's all my ministerial life was education.
You went into the Dominican Sisters.
Except I'm not. Never was a school teacher. I hate that. I taught children. I didn't teach school.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah.
When you began that journey, did you expect to have all those different experiences? Were you interested in different types of education?
No. I know. I thought I would teach children, because I realized the importance of it. In fact, after I had been teaching for a few years, Sister Thomas, who was a sister on the council who was in charge of secondary schools, said, Beth, I would like to talk to you about, you know, what would you think about being a high school teacher? And I said, I wouldn't, sister. I think it's more important that we teach in elementary school. And she said, well, better women have changed their mind. Anyway, she died before she saw that I wound up doing different things. But that's all.
And when you started teaching in upper levels, what did you think of it?
Oh, it was great. You know, I never did teach in high school. Mm-hmm. I taught in college and grad school even, but not in high school. But what I really remember, it was the funniest experience of my teaching life. When I finished as principal at the campus school, which was an elementary school that we own in Madison, and I went and I got my doctorate there in Wisconsin and went to Mount Mary to teach in Milwaukee. Now, the joke of that was the sisters I had in high school, Mount Mary was, you know, one step short of heaven because they were school sisters in Notre Dame, and that was their college. So it was kind of like coming home in some ways. But anyway, I was teaching kids that were going to become teachers, of course. And in grade school, you know, you kind of have to corral the lambs and, you know, get them kind of in a desk and, you know, hopefully get their eyes on you. You know, in those days, that was the teaching mode. And in college, I started speaking and they started writing what I was saying immediately. I mean, I was just like saying practically good morning, you know, whatever. So I thought, oh, this is fun. But anyway, I only stayed there a couple of years because when I found that I had, you only teach about, I was teaching, I think, 9 credits, 12 credits in a week. I was reading the higher ed journal cover to cover in the library because I had so much time. I thought, this is crazy. I'm too young to do this. I'll do this when I'm old. Anyway, so then somebody called me and I wound up going to Phoenix as the superintendent of schools. And I loved it. It was great. You know, it was the time of some difficulties, financial difficulties in the diocese, and we needed to build and we needed to expand. And I wasn't for staying around particularly for that to happen. So then I went to Pittsburgh as superintendent. And I only got to stay, that was great, that too. I love all the places I've been, actually. I went to Pittsburgh as superintendent, and after 2.5 years, I was called to congregation service. So, bye. So I went to the mound for 6 years. And then there weren't any I won't even tell you that story. Then I went out to Portland and taught for a year. And I was the academic advisor to the student athletes. So my office was in the, you know, athletic building. But I taught teachers there also, and also supervised kids that were volunteers, you know, academic volunteers in the schools. Anyway, but then that was so far away. My family was, you know, my sister had died while I was out there, and my nieces and nephews, you know, now I'm the oldest one in the family, blah, blah. Anyway, so then I went to Rochester, New York, as superintendent. Then I went on a sabbatical. And then I went to Florida. There weren't any superintendencies at that point that I wanted to apply for. So a school that we had started down there needed a principal, and they had people with Dominican background for the history of the school. So I went down there to be principal for my last active ministry. And then I retired and came up here to Chicago to live with their sisters. Boy, that's a long story, isn't it? People say, after they hear the rendition of Where I've Been, they always say, did you have trouble keeping a job, Beth? But it was all my decision, thank God.
What were some of the biggest challenges of keeping that Dominican mission?
Ministerially, the biggest challenge in terms of ministry in my life was working for the congregation. It's school, I know what needs to be done. I know how to work with people. You know, the expectations are pretty universal. But it was a time of change, a time for needed change, and it was hard. You know, mm-hmm. Dominican sisters are always going to second guess you, and you better have three good reasons why, you know, you get up in the morning, because that's hard. But I'm glad I did it. I think we did some good things for the congregation, but it was the hardest part.
Okay, so tell me about how the Dominican Pillar of Study has influenced your life.
I think it kind of played to one of my strengths. It's probably more why Dominican life resonated with me. Because I remember, you know, being an avid reader as a child. I remember my father I was complaining one night that you'd get done. In those days, when I was in school, they gave you an assignment. And when you got it done, you had to wait until everybody else in the room got it done. And you couldn't get out of your seat. You're just kind of just stuck there. So my father said, well, Beth, you always have a dictionary in your desk. And that was another thing, you always had a dictionary in your desk. So he said, read the dictionary. So I did, you know, so that set me well. But after that, I also tried to remember having a library book with me at all times. And, you know, and it's one of the joys of community life is that you're surrounded by other people who are also studying and also reading, and also particularly now, you know, in our life when we're not reading professional reading so much, I think more people are reading theology and ecology that many. And so you're surrounded by other people for whom study is a priority.
Mm-hmm. Have there been any specific areas of study that interested you or that you worked on particularly?
Well, my undergrad degree is in mathematics, so that didn't bring a lot of rain as far as, you know, reading. But I of course, am going to be interested in theology, you know, and I'm getting into, just starting to get into things on, like, climate change that I know the broad strokes, but I don't know a lot of information, you know, on that type of thing. So I want to kind of get into that. We're also looking at a book study right now on the book cast. Wilkerson, young African American woman. It's excellent. And what it does is parallel. Why am I telling you this? You don't need to know this. Anyway, anti-racism. Mary is our leader, and We belong to a white caucus here with some lay people and ourselves, you know, looking at anti-racism and trying to become an anti-racist congregation, which is a lot harder than you would think. Okay, that's all.
Have you found areas of study among Dominican sisters to range pretty widely, you know, science and social science?
Oh, I've lived with people who have doctorates in all these things at one time or another. You know, Esther, who taught social studies, was an authority on women in prison because that's what she did her doctoral dissertation on. And it was most interesting. And other people, you know, history of different eras, you know, and English, theology, you know. We're surrounded by people who are extremely well informed in different ways.
So moving to
this sounds unreal, doesn't it? We better get more real here, Mayor. We gotta get some negativity in here. Come on. Okay. What?
Well, we have Vatican II coming up, so we can.
No, that's not bad news.
Well, the previous.
Yeah.
Tour,
yeah.
So looking at prayer, how has your prayer life changed over time?
Certainly it's less formalized, much more interior, much more embedded in silence, mindfulness. And even the time that you have to give to prayer is so great, you know, in retirement. Because otherwise, you know, you get up, you get ready, you get dressed, you went to prayers with the community, which was, you know, reading out of a book. And hopefully, as you got older, the words in the book meant more to you than they did when you were young. But nonetheless, you know, it was kind of pro forma. And then you went off to school, then you got home. You had to start helping, doing this or that, or laundry or something. And then after dinner, you prepared for classes the next day. So there wasn't a lot of time. Now there is. Well, both because of Vatican II and most of all because of our retirement, you know. Mary says when she retired, she said, I can just read anything I want at night. I thought, boy, that's real freedom. You don't even think about that, but it's true. Yeah.
Have you seen community changes around prayer over the course of?
I don't know. I don't know what to say. The fact that I live with three other people is very unusual. I think outside of the mother house and our retirement places, mm-hmm. ours is the largest house in the congregation. A lot of people live alone. So obviously they're not going to have the kind of office that we say in the morning. But you kind of have to have that when you have a group of people. You know, I think in the 70s and 80s, maybe people were going into faith-sharing groups and all that, but everybody isn't into that, you know. But I do think that I can tell from living with people and the people that I know, friends that I am not living with, that all of our prayer lives have deepened during our lifetime in different ways, perhaps. But I think that that's kind of inevitable. It's kind of, I suppose, the parallel between the interaction of a couple when they're newly married and when they've been living together for 40 years. You know, the depth of it may not look as exciting, but it is probably more meaningful.
How has your understanding of Dominican life changed over time?
Well, you know, when we entered, I asked God, we drank the Kool-Aid. You know, nuns were nuns, and we thought we were going to be like that. You know, at least I did. I mean, it didn't occur to me that radical changes were going to occur. Now, by the time Vatican II came, we had been in the congregation about 7 years. And by that time, we probably would have had suggestions for improvement, but nobody was going to ask us at 25. Mm-hmm. So can that. But nonetheless, Vatican II came out of the grace of God and the wisdom of John the 23rd. And as we were hearing about this and reading about this, Cardinal Sunan's The Nun in the Modern World, pivotal book you probably never heard of. That was a turning point in our lives. We were in our 20, 21 when that book came out, and it was a precursor to what Vatican II asked sisters to do, which was to modernize, to get in touch more with the current world as opposed to dressing like we did in the 12th century, and 13th century, I should say. We were asked to look at our charism, look at what it was that was the essence of our lives, and focus on that rather than on the externals of so many things. I think that, you know, we used to get new names when we became sisters, you know, as a sign that we were entering into a new vocation, not unlike Simon became Peter, mm-hmm. Saul became Paul. Well, guess what? The Vatican II said, we are all living our vocations out of baptism. Thus, most of us went back to our baptismal names. Nobody understands why except us, I guess. But anyway, that's what it is. There are still people who have their religious names, though. They didn't go back. Evidently, that argument didn't. It was not compelling to them, or else they had had this name, this religious name, for enough time that they saw themselves as that. And often it was named, they were named after a form of their father or mother's name or an aunt or an uncle or something. But anyway, so there were a lot of changes in Vatican II, and we were more than welcome for all of them. Charlotte and I were walking across the Grand Concourse, Fordham Road in the Bronx. We were both teaching in Our Lady of Mercy during the Vatican II. And I forget why we were crossing the street. We were probably going to the store. Anyway, I remember saying to her, "Do you think we're going to ever be able to mail our own letters?" She said, "Oh, I don't know." She said, "But, you know, we used to have to hand letters to our superior unopened, unsealed." And, of course, she's the only one that had stamps, too. I think one of us said, "Well, where would we get the stamps?" So, I mean, life was so very different. So very different. You can hardly fathom it. But we were happy, you know, and things were fine. But it got better. Anyway, so then we gradually, you know, the first thing was we each got $2 a month for an allowance. You could spend it wherever you wanted. There weren't too many places even then that you could buy much for $2. But I remember we spent a lot of time in card stores because you could buy a card to send somebody. Because now we could send cards too. Anyway, unbelievable when you think about it. That's enough about Vatican II. That isn't too profound, but those are my little remembrances. People started leaving. There was a downside. I don't know. I really don't. I have some theories, but I don't really know why everybody started leaving when things were getting better. But I think that they felt more free than they evidently had before. And so maybe they were free to see themselves in a whole different way. And so, you know, people were leaving. Well, I remember, again, going for a walk with somebody and saying, you know, we had been told that after you were professed, that was a sign that you had a vocation. And so to leave would be to reject God's grace. Not good, that kind of guilt trip. Now, after Vatican II, I don't think anybody thought that anymore. They thought that, you know, God made us to love him and to be happy. And if this isn't going to work for you, there you go. Who are you hurting? You know, nobody. But anyway, that was hard for those of us who stayed because you missed people, you know. Now, actually, three of my best friends left many years ago. And one of my very best friends, Colleen Terry, and I are still talking almost every week. And, you know, so we still have in common what we always did. Mm-hmm. But that was the hardest part of Vatican II, I think, for me.
Did you have conversations about them leaving?
Not, but mm-hmm. Some, yes. Yeah. And it was different reasons for different people. Yeah.
What were some common reasons?
They wanted more freedom than the life allowed mm-hmm. to them. They, in one case, they had met a Dominican priest who had left and were leaving in order to be with him. Another found community life difficult. I don't know. Mary, you're an extrovert, aren't you?
No.
Aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm an introvert.
You could fool me. But anyway, okay. Well, I'm definitely an extrovert. And so, you know, I never knew a crowd I didn't like, you know. But I think that for people who were extreme, you're not an extreme introvert. I think it's hard, you know, because at that point, it's not true anymore, but at that point, you get thrown together with people that you had nothing, a apparently in common with other than a desire to serve God and mm-hmm. one another, you know. But, you know, some people were difficult. When you said, the bad things, you know, became good things, you know, my biggest example, our novice mistress was, to say the least, overwhelming. And tough and no nonsense. I mean, not mean, but just, okay. Well, I get out on mission, my first teaching assignment, and the superior is just like, and I thought, you know, if I hadn't had Marie Walter, I would have caved. I would have left. But you know what? I figured this too shall pass away, and sure enough it did. And the real corker is she eventually left the congregation. There was some satisfaction on my part, but I tried to gunny sack it.
Okay, so I'm moving back to Harry here and back to Vatican II.
By the way, how are we doing? Oh, no, this isn't good. Go ahead.
So, Mary, how did you experience Vatican II?
How did I get
Well,
into
I think
Vatican
it probably crept in slowly, and there were probably books to read. I remember 1966 and 67, 40, this is what I remember, 40 of our sisters. Well, Vatican II, the dates were 1962 to 1965. Not continuously, but, you know, back and forth the bishops mm-hmm. went to Rome. 1966 and 67, 40 of our sisters were invited to come to the Mother House to talk about the new implications for us, Dominican sisters, and for religious life. And so one of the first things we did was we took this old, what we call the little black book. It was really called our constitutions. These were the guys, like the Constitution of the United States, you know, the president makes a pledge to follow it, to live it out. Well, we had the Constitution, but it had ridiculous things, like the sisters shall keep their hair cropped shortly. Well, the first thing we were supposed to do with this black book, we were to get together, cross out all the things that we thought no longer applied. And we found out that we were crossing out over 90%, you know, of what was in that black book. And then little by little, we became more aware of how things were changing. I remember very vividly, I have this picture in my mind, in 1969, I was teaching at Cathedral High School in Omaha, and the church associated with this school was the home of the archbishop, so it would be like the cathedral. It was a cathedral, thank you. It was a cathedral. And it was being remodeled, and so we had mass in the gym of the high school. And I can still picture people coming out, Sunday morning, mass, we'd just been to mass in the gym, coming out and say, oh, in English, the mass is said in English. And people were so happy about that. So that was one, you know, kind of event. And then shortly thereafter, so that was 1969, 1970, January, I went to Bolivia. And the sisters lived a much different life there. They lived in a regular house, you know, not a convent. And I remember the other sister that I went with, we got there, and we said, to the sister who was the superior who gave permission for everything and watched over everything. Said, we don't think we should have superiors anymore. And she said, oh, okay. We said, well, we think that we should sit down and talk these things over and decide what we're going to do. So that's kind of how we began to live that way. And then also I was greatly influenced by liberation theology, which came out of Latin America in 1970, and the whole focus was on the people. We were supposed to be helping people become free and know that they were important, they were blessed by God, and they could pursue their own freedom. So that gave me a different look on how things should be. And also, I had been removed, you know, from the religion by the book, You know, every Sunday you go to Mass, and this is what it's supposed to be, and this is how you participate. I've been freed from all that because some of those regulations and stipulations had not arrived in Bolivia. So that was the beginning, and my life and my outlook have changed ever since because of that.
So Beth has talked a little bit about sisters leaving. How has the diminishing number of religious sisters in the U.S. affected you? Or people leaving your congregation?
Well, I think when this started, probably in the late 60s, early 70s, the sister with whom I had gone to Bolivia, it was her turn to go home for what we called a home visit. And we took her to the airport. We said, bye, we'll see you in February, because home visits were October to February. We'll see you in February. We came back home, and her window was closed, and her door was closed. So I thought, well, she's going to be gone for 3 months, for heaven's sakes. You know, we're not going to keep this place all closed up. So I opened the door, and the bedroom was empty. We had not heard a word about her decision, you know, to leave, until we kind of sort of figured it out. We got word from somebody that, oh yeah, so-and-so, you know, she's left and she went home. And so I began to think about that, and I thought to myself, yeah, I remember trying to comfort her, you know, in the middle of the night, and I couldn't comfort her. She said, you don't understand. And I said, no, I don't understand. Well, she had fallen in love with a priest. And I think many of the people that I knew, it was a story about falling in love with a priest. The sisters' lives had opened up. Maybe you heard from what I said earlier, you know, as teachers of children in schools, we went to school, we came home, we prepared our lessons, we kept the convent clean, we ate and studied, and that was it. But now sisters were able to go out. And so I was studying in the summer, I think of 68 and 69, and at a place, Loyola here, Pastoral Institute, and sisters and priests were going out and having dinner together. We would call that dating. And little by little, this pair went off and that pair went off. So my impression is that most people left because they've had fallen in love. But somebody that Beth referred to, I remember this individual saying to me, you know, my arena, my world for loving others is so confined as a sister. I want to love more people. And, you know, she's an extremely loving, outgoing person. And I thought to myself, yeah, you know what, that fits her. Because our life was very, very confined. Very stipulated is not the word. Very orderly. Very orderly. In the olden days, 365 days of the year, someone else told us what to do and where to be. We didn't have to make any of those decisions. We just did it. And so Vatican II made a big difference in my life, and gratefully, you know, I think in the lives of others. I don't know a lot of people, you know, who left. And so I don't have a lot of experience of different reasons, but I think Beth probably spoke well to that.
Well, Beth, more broadly, either before or after Vatican II, tell me about your relationship with the Catholic Church. How has that evolved?
Well, that... I'd have to go back to childhood, you know. I mean, who did I? Oh, I know what it was when we were interviewed by the people in the sociology department. I was thinking, why would I talk about this? Anyway, growing up on the south side of Chicago, I thought Irish Catholic Democrat was one word. I mean, when a couple of Italian families moved in over on the far side of the parish, they talk about the neighborhood changing. it was pitiful, really, if you think about it. But it was the world that I grew up in, and it was like, do the fish question the water, you know? So I was a good fish. Anyway, I mean, the fact that I believe the nuns, you know, they know better. And, you know, I didn't have a problem with the Catholic Church. No, you know, still, you know, you could certainly see flaws in the system, you know, and so forth. I think somehow, you know, now we're going to skip like, about 60 years to where we are now. I think that there are some major problems that all of the churches are facing, but what I know is the Catholic Church. And I think that there are major changes in store, and part of it is going to be the enormous diminishing of Catholics. The second largest religious group in the United States is former Catholics. Now, the church is in a bind because in the triumphalistic days of the 19th century, they made the foolish mistake of enunciating that the church, the Pope in league with whatever, the bishops or whatever, you know, couldn't make a mistake practically, you know. It hasn't panned out for them very well. But again, they're not willing to face it. Nothing worse for reform than not being able to admit you need reform. So, you know, I'm Catholic. I'll certainly probably be Catholic for my whole life. But I feel terrible about what I see. It is so obvious to so many that the church is not able or willing to admit.
What are some major areas do you see that need reform?
Well, I think maybe I'd like to start, because just if this doesn't change, nothing's going to change. The patriarchal notion that men are going to decide what is true for everybody else, that truth is going to be transmitted from God through them to everybody else. That somehow, and again, this was 2 weeks ago, this poor young guy, nice little fellow that was just made the pastor, he's about 35 years old, and he talked about vocations on Good Shepherd Sunday, and how completely in the face of Vatican II talked about the priest and then the people, you know, the religious and the brothers and then the married people and then the blessed and then the unmarried lay people, you know, in a hierarchical way. And I'm thinking, oh my God, is he blind? Does he not see that everybody in this church practically is married? Does he really think that he's doing something better for God than they are? You know, it's that kind of thing that is just inexcusable. But he had to have been taught that in the seminary. Guess who teaches in the seminary? The same people who have the opportunity to shape these young. So the priests that we knew, the Vatican II priests, are retiring now. And they have been replaced by pre-Vatican II young people. I remember a Dominican priest out in Phoenix said to me, you know, Beth, he said, you guys shouldn't have given up community life. It's one of the things that you had to offer a young woman that, you know, that they would enter, one of the reasons. He said, We're only getting vocations because of the perk of ordination. Wow. Now, isn't that a fine kettle of fish? And also, what kind of people do you think would be attracted to that notion? People who want to be dominant, top-down people, you know? It's just, it's very sad. But you know what? God's still in the heaven, and all will be right. But we're going through a very difficult time. And you know, we think, when we talk about Christianity, you know, we're talking about 2,000 years. I don't think that they understand that the world's been around for about at least 13 billion and a half years, and that this little glitch on the screen is not the whole story. You know, it kind of makes you humbler. Mm-hmm. We should, that's what we should pray for, is humility in the church. Mm-hmm. For myself, who I always think I'm right too. So I can identify with these people, but it's still pathetic.
What do you see as some of the sources for pushback against Vatican II? You know, these younger
seminaries. You know, did you ever hear the old expression, power corrupts, mm-hmm. and absolute power corrupts absolutely? I think that that's part of it. Good part. Mm-hmm. There were some who never accepted it. It's not unlike the Republicans are going through at the present time. I never thought of that before, but it is kind of like that. Wow, that's scary.
So Mary, moving, you know, including Vatican II, but also beyond that, are there world events that have really impacted your life and your religious congregation?
Well, I can speak more about my own life, but I can start with the religious congregation. I think one of the things that's happening right now is that we are realizing that very few women are joining our congregation, which means that our numbers are quickly diminishing. And therefore, for example, one thing that has to be dealt with is the fact that we have this huge campus with space for, I don't know how many square feet, but space for a lot of people. We don't need that anymore. And it's costing us millions of dollars, you know, to heat it, to cool it, to maintain the roof, the plumbing, whatever. So I think that that's one of the things that the congregation, you know, has to look at. I think that's something that I probably have to look at, which I think is a good thing. For me, it's a good thing. I never liked the fact that, and this is kind of two-sided, I never liked the fact that sisters enjoyed so much prestige. I want to be special, you know, to the people that who love me. And I want to be special to God, but I don't want to be special out there. I want to be just like everybody else, no better and no worse. And so I think one good thing that has come about, because there are fewer of us, because we're not wearing habits anymore, we can go out in a crowd and not be singled out. I think that's a good thing. But I also think that, well, as I get older, and Beth has talked about this, I think I am less concerned about rules, you know, for human beings, or rules by government, or rules by the church. And so I've set some of my own rules, which has freed me up considerably. And so that I like. I like the fact that I'm retired and have more time to do the kinds of things that Beth is talking about. I like the fact that people are not putting demands on me because I am retired. So I'm in a good place as an older retired sister. I am almost at the age at which my mother died. And I thought my mother was old. I mean, I thought she was really old. But we're living longer. And so this generation is not like the previous generation necessarily. And our challenges are different too.
Mm-hmm. Considering how you've seen how things have changed over the past, you know, 40 years or more, how do you you see the future of Dominican life in the U.S. going forward?
Well, I'm thinking of one very positive activity that is taking place right now, and that is I think there are 17 congregations of Dominican women in the United States. I don't know what our total numbers are. But we're beginning to talk. Well, yes, we're beginning to talk about doing things together. We did this about 25 years ago, but it didn't take root then. We didn't have the same need for coming together to survive. But now we see that not only do we need to do this to survive, but we want to do this. I like being with other Dominican sisters rather than just, oh, those presentations or those Franciscans or those this or this or this. Because I like our lifestyle. I like the way we and because we're so few, I know everybody, at least by name. Not intimately, but I know everybody. At least we're a little over 300 people now. So I think we're going to be joining with other and our younger members have been meeting for, I don't know, 15, 20 years. And these are the people who are going to be their colleagues in ministry and in community. One of the things that I like about this particular project, this movement, is that they're asking sisters to think about living and working together for the mission of preaching the gospel and teaching. It's not that, well, I like living in Chicago, so I want to live with other sisters here. No. It's because there's a particular mission. So maybe sisters who want to live and work at the border might come together. Sisters who are interested in housing for the poor might decide that they are going to live and to work together. So I like that. You know, put the mission first.
Are these changes a collaborative effort? Are they led by a certain congregation or person?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. It seems to be a group effort by everyone involved. But we of Sinsinawa are the second largest group of 17. So I would imagine that we're putting our resources out there for other people. They're also asking for a group of 7 people, younger people, who would be willing to come together to work to further this project, to bring us closer together and to figure out how this might be done. So I think they're making very good steps, and ordinary sisters like myself are being kept informed, you know, about what's happening. So mm-hmm. I think that's good.
So Beth, looking at both your congregation and maybe, you know, Dominican religious life in general, how would you like that to be remembered?
I don't think it's so important that we be remembered. Mm-hmm. I think that if we have done what we set out to do, however limited a way we were able to do it, the influence for most of us has already been had. That's all any of us can do. You know, I remember thinking when I was really pretty young in religious life, you know, you can either mean everything to a very few people, or you can influence a lot of people a little bit, but all of us are important. And I think that our lives have been given to a lot of people, thousands. But are we remembered by all of them? Maybe we made friends certainly along the way, and you know, people we admire, they admire us, whatever. But we each are remembered by those who love us.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that that's particularly something that is important for us to think about.
Well, Sister Mary, Sister Beth, is there anything else you'd like to say about your experiences?
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't know if this was going to be hard, but it really wasn't hard at all. But there was something else that I was going to throw into this pie, but I can't remember. But we'll see again. If I think of anything else, I'll let you know. What about you, Mary?
No, I think I've said everything I want. Well, I could say a whole lot more, but I think I'll put a period on this interview.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very satisfied with it.
Good.
Okay.
Well, thank you both for sharing, taking the time.
Uh-huh.